It's officially DC festival season, and we're super excited about this one coming up on May 18th. Africa on the Avenue is a celebration of the vibrant African immigrant community along Georgia Avenue Northwest. There's going to be interactive art installations, fashion shows, music, food, and local business stands. This one-day festival, organized by District Bridges' Lower Georgia Avenue Main Street program, truly has something for everyone. So I'll see you there on May 18th. Go to districtbridges.org to learn more.
Today on CityCast DC, we sat down with Randy Clark, who runs the metro system. Clark's new budget proposal is not full of the kind of draconian changes that were on the table last year, but he is still managing a lot of the challenges, and according to him, a lot of the opportunities that come with running a mass transit system in a post-COVID city. Today is Thursday, April 25th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and here's what DC is talking about. Hey, Randy, good to see you.
Hey, good seeing you again. How you been?
I've been all right. So you have announced your projected 2025 budget for Metro. And originally, when we talked in December, there was supposed to be $750 million in cuts. Did that get solved or is it still in dire straits?
We have a revised budget that we put out several months ago. I anticipate the board approving that. There's some very, I would call them targeted efficiencies, and there is a fare increase, but there is not the cuts that actually the whole region was worried about. I mean, really, what really came together here is the whole region, all the jurisdictions came together to help close a big part of the metro budget gap. It's not the whole thing. We are using part of our capital preventive maintenance fund to do a piece of this. Obviously, staff, we're taking a zero increase next year as staff, which is a challenge across the staffing. And then we found a bunch of other efficiencies as well. But the win here for our customers is we're actually protecting the service. And so we're going to be able to continue to recover and drive a really good, frequent, safe, reliable system on bus and rail and access for our customers.
So that is a pretty big change from last time you and I talked, which was in December, at a time when it was sort of one of these cycles when really draconian cuts were being proposed, closing stations and so on. What changed?
I mean, really, our region coming together. So we did everything we could really control on our end. So we came up with $50 million of cuts that didn't impact service directly, which is very, very difficult to do. Again, staff has taken a 0% increase, and that is not reflective of all of the incredible work the team is doing here. And I think overall, the community is recognizing the work that the team is doing. We're using some preventive maintenance money, but the big step up here is whether it's Governor Moore. He came out first with his budget and the legislature in Maryland passed their piece. The mayor and the council jointly came out with their statement about Metro. And now we're looking forward to the Virginia piece kind of wrapping up between Governor Youngkin and the General Assembly. And basically everyone on the Virginia side has acknowledged how critical Metro is for the region and for the Commonwealth. So all in all, it's a lot of leaders coming together and acknowledging the criticality of Metro. Without Metro, this region cannot thrive, let alone survive.
So you appear pretty sanguine about Virginia kicking in its piece.
I'm really optimistic. I really enjoyed working with everyone in Virginia. I feel very confident. We're just one element in a very complex political situation in Virginia, but I think all that stuff is going to get worked out. And I've yet to meet anyone that doesn't believe that Metro needs the funding to succeed long term. I appreciate everyone jumping on the train or bus or whatever other analogy you want to use with us together on this adventure.
Tell me about the rate hike that is being proposed.
In one way, unfortunately, we do have to raise the fares, but in all fairness, this is really about adjusting our fares more or less to inflation. So we are proposing a 12.5% fare increase. So for the average fare, it's like a quarter is basically the way most people will look at it. Now, it does change on distance a little bit, and there's the way our model works, but that's more or less what most people will see. No one wants to pay more, I get that, but obviously everything in our lives has gone up in the last 3 or 4 years, pretty significantly. So we only believe this is the right way to balance kind of the inflationary pressure. We also are changing our weekend policy a little bit. An evening policy that used to be $2 flat. It'll now be $2, but with a cap of $2.50. So still very cheap and affordable to get around, but trying to just collect a little bit more revenue on the weekend specifically because there is a ton of people to use the system on the weekend, and those trips are very expensive. You know, overall, it's not a gigantic increase. All increases are personal, obviously, and we appreciate that, but we just think it's a fair way to help balance the load of the costs.
So one of the nice things about not being in a sort of existential crisis situation like last winter is we can talk about other things. And it seems to me like there's sort of two ways to go. One is about a lot of the regular things that riders notice when they go around the metro. People, obviously, as you know, people have concerns about fare evasion. People are wondering what's going to happen to the circulator bus. People have all the different day-to-day concerns you have in a transit system. And then the other thing that is important to talk about, I think, when you're not facing down a crisis is the kind of long-term health of the system. So I want to pick your brain about both of these things.
Sure.
But why don't we start with the day-to-day? You've gone very hard at fare evasion. Can you tell me how that's going?
I love our system, and I'm pushing to be as clean and safe and reliable as you could possibly be. So the day-to-day stuff that people are caring about, fare evasion is clearly one. So I'm proud of the team. We've reduced fare evasion by over 50% on the rail side, probably in the last 6 to 8 months.
How do you measure that?
Well, our system can measure that. Like, we have sensors in all of our gates that can detect if someone's jumping, if someone's piggybacking, all of those types of behaviors. We also are seeing way more fare transactions, both virtual and at the machines. So we're down about 50%. Every place that we put the new gates, we're averaging somewhere between 75% reduction. So every day that we keep adding gates across the system, and we'll be done by the end of the summer, we're starting to get the pairing of the trips. So if you go from this station to this station, it started where, oh, my trip, I can still fare evade because neither place had it. And if one side had it, it was harder. Now both sides have it. It's, you know, getting close. We're never going to have zero fare evasion. There was never zero fare evasion before COVID. There was never zero evasion in 1975. We, though, are working to eliminate as much of that as possible and doing it in the most cost-effective way, too. Because I don't want to spend $1,000 to get $2. But there's other benefits of reducing fare evasion. We've significantly, we believe, cut down on some quality of life and criminal element inside the system. So a good example is 2 weeks ago on fare evasion patrols, we had 4 people in 1 day arrested for fare evasion, 3 people with outstanding warrants, and 1 person was a wanted fugitive and had a loaded Glock 9mm illegal gun.
And if he'd paid his $2.25, he'd be on the street right now.
Yeah, well, guess what? Otherwise, this guy's probably going to prison for a while, and then the community's safer for that. So this is a good example of point entry policing does have some overall safety benefits for the whole system. But we also, again, you know, are trying to do it in the most community-minded way. We set up a low-income fare program called Metro Lift. If there's people in our community that need a hand up, and if you're on SNAP, we're now giving 50% discount across the whole region. That is a big deal to help people that truly need help. We have kids programs, we have senior programs, we have disability programs. All we're really asking is the rest of us that can afford to pay your fare.
Are you able to game out how much of the reduction in fare evasion is because of arrests and enforcement and how much is because of the physical infrastructure?
Yeah, it's hard because we're doing like 15 things at once, right? And so we're not doing a science experiment where we can isolate a variable. We are trying to use data and try to, you know, because we want to be cost effective with each part of the solution, but they work really well together because when we put new gates up, we need less cops to do fare evasion at that place because it's really obvious who's fare evading. You know, some guy that's jumping over a gate, it's much easier for the cop to get the one person doing that where the old way, punching people were jumping, right? So they kind of work and complement each other.
What are the Metro staffers who are in the booths supposed to do when they see fare evasion? Are they supposed to act or
no? No, so the station managers, they have no legal authority to deal with fare evasion. So the law is very clear. The only people that can do fare evasion, the way the jurisdictions create the law, is police. Station patrols, they're there to do customer service. And I know visually sometimes people get frustrated. They're like, I went by and someone's in the booth. It's like, we're not playing CSI here where every single person can be stopped instantaneously. You know, we'll move 850,000 plus people today. And it's not, you know, we can't track every single person that way. But legally, that we can only do fare evasion via the police.
You know this better than me, but fare evasion, even though it's actually a really small amount of money involved in each individual case, it enrages non-fare evaders like almost nothing else. I mean, it's like watching someone litter or something, throw a milkshake on the ground and keep walking because it seems so cavalier. What do you do? Like, if you see someone jump in a fence, do you say like, hey, what are you doing? Or do you just let them go and not have a confrontation?
So one, I would remind everyone that I get why people believe that they should call things out. And we don't need vigilantes around the system, like trying to act like police officers, right? Mm-hmm. Police officers have legal authority to do certain things. And our job is to continue to try to get fare evasion down to the lowest possible amount. And yeah, it gets emotional for people. There's no question, because some people feel like I'm a sucker paying and someone else isn't. So all I can try to tell those people is we're doing our best and we are working hard at it. But there's always going to be people in society that break rules. And a lot of the people that maybe get upset with someone fare evading are some of the people that maybe get in the car and then speed and then are not upset that they're speeding. Right. So we all do things from time to time that probably don't fit perfectly in the rules. And we should understand the nature of being human is the nature of being a hypocrite sometimes. And we're all just trying to maybe do the best we can.
Everybody knows that getting that perfect Mother's Day gift is basically impossible. But we promise Mom will love this one. The Capitol Hill Restoration Society House and Garden Tour is back this Mother's Day weekend on May 11th and May 12th. Tour 9 elaborate homes and gardens and 3 historic buildings on Capitol Hill that you can't normally enter. And if you can't make it, check out the Capitol Hill Restoration Society's other events like walking tours and monthly preservation cafes. You can buy tickets for the Mother's Day House and Garden Tour on Eventbrite and be sure to follow CHRS on Facebook and Instagram at Capitol Hill Restoration DC.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
All right, so the city government, the DC government, is talking about getting rid of the circulator buses. What are the odds of some of that being absorbed into Metrobus?
Yeah, I mean, that's their decision. They run a transit service, a smaller one, obviously, than we do. We are now having conversations with them about what their plans are. They have a fleet. They have some facilities. They have staff. They run some buses in different parts of the district. So we are going through a Better Bus Network redesign already. And the question is, could some of those things maybe be merged into our services more efficiently or not? And so those are the ongoing discussions. But ultimately, the decision on the circulator is not a WMATA decision. That is purely a district decision.
So speaking of that bus system redesign, I mean, I don't know if folks haven't dived into it. It's pretty cool. There was talk of blowing up every single bus route and redrawing them, renaming them.
Yeah, Michael, we don't blow up anything.
Well, blow up is maybe the wrong word.
We're improving.
Erase and redraw. And there's a site where you can say, like, if you currently take the N2 bus, this is what we're talking about now. And some of them are exactly the same and others are different in interesting ways. Where does that stand? What's the timetable on it? What's the state of play?
Yeah, more information will be coming out around that in another month or two. And this has been a multi-year iterative process, right? We do some work, get community and rider input, do some more work, do that, plus all of our stakeholders. You know, we're working really collaboratively with all of our regional stakeholders on this. So we got the technical pretty good right now. And the technical is not arbitrary. It's really done through some advanced modeling. And you know, there's some common sense stuff involved in this too, right? Like there's bus routes that haven't changed in 40 years. And let's say one used to serve a hospital or a big school complex. And let's say the hospital complex is not there anymore. Well, the purpose for that route has adjusted significantly, whereas there might be a big school or big, huge housing areas or big activity center that isn't served well because we never adjusted the route. So change is always hard for people. There's going to be everything from crazy excitement that, oh my God, my bus service just got so much better, to clear people be upset to say, you changed my bus service and now I have to walk a block that I didn't have to walk before, or my transfer is a little different. We are obviously a mass transit system trying to make a bus system. And we're going to therefore have some that don't feel as good about it and some that will feel great. And an overwhelming majority in the middle will just say, all right, that's a little bit better, but it doesn't really impact me that much. The goal here is to get the next round of community engagement. What we'd like to do is implement this next spring springish to really roll this out. But we're one of the last serious transit agencies in the country to do this. Most all agencies have moved this thing forward. It's much more cost effective, brings much more reliability and quality service to customers, and almost universally will drive more ridership because it makes the bus system more accessible and actually goes more places where people want to go in a streamlined way. So it's a big deal for Metro and for this region.
Have you thought about holding a public contest to name the routes?
No.
I mean, any sucker can live on the L2 bus, but you could only be cool if you lived on like the giraffe bus line.
Yeah, there we go. I don't know if there's enough animals in the there, but but we are going to look at the naming because a lot of the naming is based on like these old trolley streetcar things. And some of them don't make any sense because they were in D.C. but didn't go to Maryland, or they were in Maryland and didn't go to D.C. or they were Virginia when there was a bridge and there wasn't a bridge. So a lot of this is just modernizing and cleaning up the way people live their lives. You know, versus why do I have to know where the L2 goes? And why was it called the L2? Most people don't care. They just want to go like, hey, if I go to this bus stop, where can I go and how often does it come?
I know, but there's always one person at the dinner party who knows. And that guy's like the toast of the town.
There is. Yeah. No question. And trust me, no matter where I go, that person comes and talks to me.
So one other thing you guys have dropped recently, which is this summer is going to be a pain in the butt for a bunch of people on the Eastern end of the Red Line. Tell us what's happening. You've got some stations closing and bus lane replacements.
Yeah. So this is being done to support our partners in Maryland. So many of your listeners might not know, but WMATA is not building the Purple Line. But part of the project is building a mezzanine at Silver Spring that will connect the Purple Line, the Red Line, and a bunch of other components. You know, there's a MARC platform and other things up there together. We can't run trains while that work is being done overhead. But we certainly couldn't do it cost efficiently or over a rate. It would just spread this thing out over like forever. So we are shutting down to support Maryland DOT doing this project. So we will shut down Glenmont, Wheaton, Forest Glen, Silver Spring, and Tacoma. Now, Tacoma, we're only shutting down for the first 30 days, and then it will be shortened to just those four stations. But an unprecedented amount of collaboration and partnership, Maryland DOT and the Montgomery County Department of Transportation and us, all partnered, and we now have 7+ miles of dedicated bus lane that's going to run in various segments. You can see it on our website. We got a lot of information out, but basically throughout that corridor to really move buses. I wouldn't be surprised some of our express buses that probably move equally as fast as being on the train. So not all trips are monolithic. Some people are going to Silver Spring, some are going to Fort Totten, and some people are going to Farragut North. And all those trip patterns are a little different, but our goal is to provide really good bus service. It's free bus service, and we want to get people around really seamlessly. So will there be a couple of hiccups? Of course. It's a complex thing, but we're feeling pretty confident that we're going to be able to really get people around during this shutdown. And, you know, we appreciate people's patience and empathize that no shutdown is good, but we're also going to do a lot of metro maintenance during this outage so we can not have to go back to this section for a long, long, long time. And really do a lot of, you know, safety critical maintenance in there and really be done with the Glenmont to Fort Totten area as best we can.
So let's talk about big picture for a second, if you don't mind. In December, last time we talked, you were facing down, potentially at least, pretty draconian cuts. And this is a recurring theme for you and for anyone who's had your job because of the nature of the way Metro is funded. And once you start saying words like dedicated funding stream, a lot of people's eyes glaze over. But can you explain the sort of, this is, I think, the central financial challenge of the metro system, no matter who's in charge, no matter who's writing it. Can you explain it so folks will understand?
I'll do my best because it's kind of a conundrum inside of an enigma. And you're right. No matter who the general manager is or the board is or the elected officials in the area, it's the model. The structure that we have set up is very different than any other transit system in the country. So one, we're the only transit system that goes across multiple jurisdictions. That's not normal, right? I'm not saying it's bad. It's just not normal. So we have a structure built with four partners, Virginia, Maryland, and DC, but also the federal government. That is abnormal. And again, I'm not saying this is the way it has to be, but I'm just giving an example. Cap Metro had its own sales tax. If you went to Atlanta, the MARTA system has its own sales tax. If you went to Dallas, it has its own sales tax. If you went
so
to
like
LA,
everybody in Atlanta who buys a pair of shoes, some small fraction of that goes to this system every year, and they don't have to go tin cupping around to the legislature asking for money.
Yeah. And so, and again, they work different. Almost everyone has some type of thing. That means that source can only be used for transit at that authority. And what that does, the dedication, it's not just the volume of money, it's the type of sourcing of the money, because the organization then has the ability to do better planning, not perfect, but better on things like workforce planning, service planning, fleet planning, capital planning. So to me, one of the things we have to just solve, and I don't know if we're going to get to a regional revenue source that everyone in three states agrees that Metro has this source of funding, or if they all come up with different ones and we keep this kind of, if you will, Frankenstein model going, but it's just a more robust and healthier Frankenstein model. I'm not sure that's my role to be exact on that. We need more certainty and predictability to run the system well. And it's better for our partners. So whether you're a local partner like Fairfax or Alexandria or Arlington or Loudoun, if you will, of Virginia, or you're a state partner like the state of Maryland, or the district's kind of its own thing, they need certainty and predictability of what our financials are going to be, not year to year, but 5, 10, 15, 20 years, both operating and capital. So the one thing I'm really excited about is Metro is partnering with the Council of Governments, and we're kicking this big initiative off on May 1st, actually. And it's kind of the first time ever our two boards are going to meet. And it's going to be all around this idea of what the vision should be for transit for our region. Again, Metro's the biggest operator, but there's all these other operators as well. How do we work on things like fare policy and bus network redesign? But also, there's an enormous amount of capital projects people want to do here, whether they're Metro projects, BRT projects for local operators, MARC and VRE through trains, all of this stuff. Ferries people have talked about forever, bike share, all of this stuff works together. We need to figure out what we want to be as a region that keeps growing and being important, and then say, how much does this cost to do this? And what are the revenue options to make that happen? And we also have to be eyes wide open. If we want stuff, we have to pay for stuff. And if we don't pay for stuff, we're not going to get the stuff that we all say we want. And that's not a Randy ultimately decision. But I think the transparency in a public forum to get all this out is going to be real healthy for this region. It really hasn't been done this way regionally in a long, long, long time.
So of the total operating cost of being Metro, how much comes from my fares and your fares, and how much comes from other governments?
Yeah, well, subsidy makes up overwhelmingly, we're probably in the 80% give or take rate on subsidy. So Metro used to be higher on fare recovery, what we would call fare recovery, but COVID, it really hurt here, New York, San Francisco. We were the systems that probably had the highest fare recovery. But transit's not supposed to be a paid-for service of fares. Is it a part of the structure? Yes. But there's no system in the world that operates that way. They're not supposed to. And we got to get everyone on the same page that we are a public service. And we got to agree, if we want a good public service, it costs money. And I use the analogy a lot, like the fire department. If we want a great fire department, you don't pay a fee when they come to your house if you're having a heart attack. You know, I've never called the fire department, but I'm willing to pay and have a really good fire department. So we just got to determine as a region what transit system we want and agree to either fund it or agree that we're not going to have what we want. And that's just the healthy conversation we need to have.
What's the percentage of ridership now compared to pre-pandemic?
Well, again, not monolithic because every day is not the same. So on weekends, we're actually carrying more people now than we did before the pandemic. On bus during the week, we're pretty close to what we carried before the pandemic, give or take, you know, maybe like 92-ish, 95%. Now it depends on the day. On the rail side, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday come up a long way. Monday and Friday are still obviously a little bit laggards. I think it was 80% in the month of March. So we keep growing every week, every month. It might take 3 years to get back totally. And it might look different, right? Rush hour at North Farragut might look different on Mondays forever. But Saturday afternoons now, I think it was almost 355,000 people on rail on Saturday. And so if you went to the Red Bull event or a Nats game or DC United or the Spirit, all, like Metro is how people are getting around. And so part of this is build a network that you could use every day of the week, not just for commuter.
Here's the thing that worries me. I see these stats like from the Castle data, the key fob company.
Okay, yeah.
What percentage of workers are in the office downtown? The number of workers in downtown DC, according to the most recent one, was still like 50% of what it used to be, which is to say, like, say there's 800,000 jobs in DC, there's only 400,000 people coming into those jobs. And I wonder if in the long run, this makes it harder when you have to go out to the legislature or the partners in Maryland or Virginia to say, we need the money. when they're saying, actually, the people who pay us, they're not going into work. I know that's not the argument you think is dispositive, but I can imagine it makes the politics of securing money for Metro, that's never been easy, even in the best of times, I imagine it makes the politics even trickier.
Yeah, I don't get me wrong. I see that point of view, but I would say the following. Does it really matter if we move 850,000 people a day or 800,000 people a day? Are we not going to have a good system for the 800 because we didn't get 50 more? And if you want more, how are we going to get them if we don't run good service, right? At the end of the day, our thing is about inducing behavior. And the way you induce behavior in transit is to have good, consistent, frequent, reliable, safe service. We can't do that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then not run a good service the rest of the day, right? We don't just get to pick Tuesday rush hour to do that. We have to agree on the type of community assets we want, and they need it to be funded accordingly, and hopefully more people will use it. You know, the old day of everyone just needing it to commute, that's a great thing. But I think equally is someone going to a doctor's appointment midday, someone going out to a restaurant at night. How about all the workers that support our service economy? And then look where all the development is. All the development in the region is where Metro stuff is. And they're not putting, you know, billion-dollar developments and hundreds of millions of dollars of apartments and all this other stuff near places where they go, oh, you're not going to run the trains and buses? It all works together, you know? Or imagine 4th of July on the mall without Metro. So I think everyone has a soberness. They know we do this exercise, but the region can't be what we love about the region without a good Metro system.
Hey, Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. If you enjoyed the show, why not tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. Bye.